This is Turn One Thought Seas. I'm Aaron.
And I'm Zach.
And this is episode 78, Dominaria in Modern, week one. A surprising number of cards have made an appearance in Modern already, and that is exceptionally interesting because it does not happen often. So we're going to go through some of that. We're going to do talk about a couple of specific cards that were standouts. Somebody as predicted broke Legend Bird. What's his name? Tayshar, Ancestor's Apostle, as we predicted. So we will cover that. Zach's going to talk about switching decks. I'm going to talk about land destruction, kind of picking the land destruction that is appropriate for what you are trying to accomplish. Then we will do the spice rack and wrap it up. It'll be hopefully a pretty tight little episode.
Yeah, hopefully. Hopefully we can
trim 90 minutes.
Hopefully we can keep it timely. Maybe a time mage would help.
Yeah. What we really need is a hero.
That's fair.
Yeah. A hero of Dominaria. So first I wanted to start with our Patreon shout outs. So for anybody who has not caught up, we started a Patreon by popular demand. It is patreon.com/turn1thoughtsies, all spelled out. We have our first Scion of Darkness, Brian, our Cabal Paladins, Kate, Johnny, Stark, and Liam, our Cabal Interrogators, Paul and Daniel, and our Cabal trainees, Jerry and Pat from Leaving a Legacy, Andrew and Aaron. So thank you so much to all of them for supporting the show. If you are interested and inclined to do so, please take a look. We have rewards. We have goals coming up for merchandise. We already covered the our first goal, like totally blew that away, which was just sort of cover the hosting cost and the sort of back end stuff. I'm going to be using that actually to sign up for SoundCloud Pro as well, because I know that is the preferred platform for some people, and the free version that we use now only lets you store one episode. Well, for us, because it's a longer form, only lets us put one episode up at a time, and it doesn't allow us to keep any of them. So every time I put up a new episode, I have to delete the old one, and we lose like all of our stats and all of our insights and stuff like that. So it will be nice to be able to use the SoundCloud platform a little more efficiently. So thank you to all of those people.
And also shout out real quick to all the people on the Discord, man. I wasn't into the Discord at first, but we got it up and we got it going, and people are, you know, commentating and making points. It's awesome. I love the community that's building. It's really cool so far.
Yeah, I have said this in the past, and it is not hyperbole. Our listeners are really great. We have a group of people that are very focused, right? Like if you come in here, you come here because you love Modern and you're passionate about it and you want to talk about it. And we have a forum for you to do that. And we would love for you to come and hang out with us. So, take a look. If there's stuff in there that you think is valuable to you, that's obviously our goal. Is to produce things of value. I did order the first round of patron rewards from our friends over at Card Kingdom. They should be here. I put in the order today, so I'll probably get it Friday. I will ship it. I'll sign everything, ship it to Zach, and then you can sign everything. And then they should be winging their way to all the various folks. So I got cards for of each thing. So the theme is like the Cabal. So I got a bunch of Cabal trainees from Judgment or whatever it was, and then Cabal Interrogator. So everybody is going to get a card of their subscription level.
Heck yeah.
And that was cute.
We got some playmats to give it away too, if anybody's interested.
Yeah. Oh man. You have so many playmats.
Dude, I cannot get rid of them. I have so many. I'm not trying to get rid of them. They're actually legitimately very cool looking playmats, but it's just like I get them at every SCG I go to, and there's just so many.
Yeah, no, it's fine. Actually, I still have some in the box in my closet from the first package you sent me. So maybe I'll wrap a couple of those up and ship them off to some people.
Well, let's get them out to some Patreons, man, or patrons, I guess.
patronesses.
There we go. No, definitely not patronesses. That's like a silvery animal cloud thing.
Sure. I missed Harry Potter. I'm like just a little bit past the age where it really hit.
Fair. Yeah, so, no, I read every single book. They were amazing.
Okay. Yeah, I totally missed them.
Fair.
All right. So you went to Atlanta, SCG style. Tell us what happened.
Well, so I went to Atlanta with the team. It was a team event, obviously. I went with one person I normally play with in, you know, my little testing group, and then also went with a good friend of ours we know that isn't, I mean, he is in our testing group. He's not, like, fully in the testing group, but he plays a lot of Legacy. We were happy to go with him. It was a really long drive from Michigan to Atlanta, which is the drive I went was, like, 13 hours. Extraordinarily long, but we spent a lot of time in the car, and as it turned out, the two guys I was with were just awesome. They made the trip a ton of fun, and I'm pretty sure I've said this before on cast, but honestly, like, one of the best things about going to just Magic events in general is just getting to see your friends and getting to hang out with them and, you know, spending time with them on the road trip. It's awesome. But past that, we played in the main event. Ended up going 6-3, unfortunately. Missed the cut, which was 6-2-1.
Rip.
Yeah, it was tough. We thought we lost round one to our Storm player casting three pieces of the puzzle and failing to find either Gifts Ungiven, Grape Shot, or Pass in Flames in 15 cards, which is
statistically unlikely.
Yeah, very unlikely, but you know, it happens. It's Magic. And we lost another game, another round where it came down. I had won my match. My Storm player in Modern had lost his. Our Legacy player was playing Death and Taxes and was on the draw and was facing down a turn two Karn Scion of Urza. And let me tell you, he did not win that game. That spiraled real quick. So we lost there. And we were 6-2 going into the last round. We got sat down against some fine-looking gentlemen we had never met. Thought it was going to be hopefully we were going to win, you know. And then there's an announcement over the loudspeaker. The pairings are wrong. They're about to reseed everybody. And lo and behold, we're paired against the Jessup team that got top four in the event. And we're on a feature match. Not the main one, not the camera one, but one of the side ones. A bunch of mulligans later and, you know, playing against strong opponents, we did not make day two. So that part of the trip was a little frustrating, but it was an awesome event. Really cool to see the new cards. Dominaria is making a huge impact in Eternal formats and Standard alike. There are some very strong cards in the set, and we're gonna hit on what exactly it's doing, because they're everywhere, man. Let me tell you.
Yeah, it is ridiculous. So I started just sort of poking through the results as they were filtering in to kind of see if our predictions had come true, and they pretty much did. Antiquities War popped up in Affinity sideboards. Damping Sphere.
That card, on a side note, that card is terrifying.
Antiquities War.
Yeah, I played against it in Standard, and admittedly, it's not Modern, but like it's worse in Standard. It doesn't come out as fast, and you actually have cards that can answer. Like it's, you know, turn everything to 5/5 effects, like a Settle the Wreckage, maybe, or like a disallow to counter the trigger.
Yep.
Those cards aren't played in Modern. There's no like answer to it. Like once this card's on the board, if you don't like remove that card from the board, everything's a 5/5 and you're dead. Like that's just what happens. Like you're out is like, I don't even know. Like you can, like you have bounce effects, like you can Cryptic Command bounce. Like really, like you're out is kill them first, but as a sideboard card, like the deck, you're not usually bringing it in where they can kill you first, so it's just, oh man, that card is a problem.
Fair. Damping Sphere, like I said, it's there. A lot of people played it. It showed up as a 2-of in a lot of decks in the sideboard. I don't know if it was particularly effective. I didn't hear anybody sort of, you know, on Twitter or
I can commentate
or anything like that be like, oh my god, this card is the breaker.
I can commentate, you know, on that actually.
Lay it on me.
Well, obviously, like I said, I mentioned before, my Modern teammate was playing Storm for the weekend, so we were kind of expecting to see a lot of Damping Spheres, just because, you know, it was a new card, you know, new cyborg tech people would be excited to try out. It is colorless, so it fits into literally any deck that wants it. So he wasn't as paranoid about it. He didn't think the card was good at all. I was trying to convince him that he was going to see it a lot more than he actually ended up seeing it. In total, in 9 rounds, he faced down 2 Damping Spheres, and he abraded one and repealed the other, and they did a total of almost nothing, and then he pretty much killed the person the turn after they played the Damping Spheres. So
I think that's probably what most people experienced, is my guess.
It is certainly good against Storm. It is not it's not the be-all, end-all. It's not like you just played a Damping Sphere and you won. Like, it's not playing Rest in Peace against Dredge. But, you know, it can't be the only thing you're doing. You can't just, like, play this card and expect to just immediately win the game. You need to either, like, add it to the hate cards you're playing already against them, or back it up with pressure, essentially. So, like, he was playing... In one of the rounds, he was playing against Affinity. And it was actually awkward because my friend, like, already brought in a Braid because he's playing against Affinity. It's, like, a no-brainer to bring that in. And this was against Jessup, actually. And Jessup played the... I think it's Dan Jessup? No. Whatever. The younger Jessup brother played it. And he played it and he, you know, had an Affinity board. And he was just like, well, I have to abrade that. I can't go off. So he abrades it. And, you know, it was good in the sense that he got to keep, you know, his Cranioplating in play. But it wasn't like I won the game. And then, in fact, that was the one game he did win, I think. So, yeah, I mean, the card is... it's nice in that, you know, it hits two different decks. But... It really isn't like, you know, you can't just put two Damping Spheres in your sideboard and be like, hey, this is my Tron hate, this is all I have for it, this is my Storm hate, this is all I have for it. It's like, you know, you kind of need it to overlap with some other hate cards against those decks to kind of, you know, get a tag team effect going where it's just like more hate to pile onto the hate you already have. Or if that's not the case, you really just have to have a quick clock. That's the only options, I guess.
Yeah, I guess that's even though on its face, right, it seems... like a powerful effect, and it is. And I guess it probably runs into a lot of the like Blood Moon problems, right? Like, you can't just play Blood Moon and have the other, like, have your Tron opponent scoop. They're just gonna be like, all right, I'll play six lands, hard cast my Wormcoil Engine, and then I still win.
Yep. No, you're 100% right. I mean, that's exactly what happens with the card. And it's awkward too, because like one of the things that would be best with the card is a quick clock, right? Like, you'd want to, you know, play this card and then start clocking them and win, but it is a two-sided effect, so it's like harder to clock them quick than it would be without it in play, right? Because like, you can't play, like, you know, Goblin Guide, Damping Sphere, Goblin Guide, Goblin Guide, Goblin Guide, because, you know, on your third turn your two Goblin Guides are going to cost, you know, one and then two,
right?
And it's awkward that it doesn't cost them anything to answer it, where it does like with Athalia, which is kind of a huge problem with it, because it's like, you know, if you're holding up like a Lightning Bolt, if you go like, you know, Mountain Go, and your opponent plays Thalia, you can't even bolt it that turn. You just, you know, you have to go back to your turn, play your land, and then bolt Thalia, and so it kind of like time walks them. This doesn't have any of that going on. They just like play it, and if like, if you had a Braid up, you just cast a Braid, and then you just go on your way. So, you know, it certainly does do things that are relevant in the modern format, and it is a powerful card, but it isn't, you know, it isn't Rest in Peace against Dredge. It's not Stony Silence against Affinity. It is... you know, it's just another piece of hate that you could pile on if you wanted it.
Yes. Precognition Field in a Storm sideboard. This actually surprised me. It was a, we talked about it a little bit before the show started. Apparently it was a tech piece that turned out to not be very good.
Yeah. Caleb Shearer and Paul Muller kind of innovated it. They said it was going to be pretty good. It was put in the sideboards for grindy matchups.
Okay.
And as it turns out, there just weren't a lot of grindy matchups this weekend. So
sure,
I could see it being good in certain matchups. Like, if you're playing Storm, you're playing against, you know, like a blue control deck that's trying to stop you, then, you know, it can be good there. But that's just generally not what's going on in Modern. So,
yeah. And Precognition Field is it's the 4-mana enchantment, and it can enchant any permanent to make it hexproof.
No.
So
Precognition Field's a 4-mana Future Sight that lets you look at the top card of your library at any time, and lets you cast instants or sorceries from the top of your library, and then you can pay 3 mana to exile the top card of your library.
Oh, I was thinking of something completely different.
Yeah, so it's like Future Sight for instance and sorceries. So it's like a grindy card for Storm. It can be good in Storm, but in general, it just wasn't what the deck wanted this weekend, I guess. But it can,
I mean,
it can be like almost like a Past in Flames that doesn't use the graveyard if you have a bunch of, you know, instants and sorceries stacked on top of your deck, you know, in the perfect order, but it doesn't play well with, like, you know, if you hit a land, it just kind of, you know, fizzles, and 3 mana to exile the land that gets stuck in your way is a lot in a Storm deck, so I don't know.
Yeah.
It, you know, it can be a powerful sideboard card, but I think it's kind of sitting in that, like, you know, 17th, 18th card in the Storm sideboard range.
Right. Yeah. Shalai, on the other hand, so this is the the angel that gives you and all your stuff hexproof. We had talked about this as being like a very simple include in like any, like any company deck, any, like evolution deck, core deck, basically any creature related, sort of green, white X deck. And she showed up all over the place in almost every single one of those decks. There was at least one. And this is, she's 3 and a white. For a 3/4 flyer, you planeswalkers you control and other creatures you control have hexproof. And then she also has a 4 green green Gavinny Township activation, but a +1/+1 counter on each creature you control, which includes her, which is pretty sick.
Yeah, I mean, Shalai is the truth.
I'm very, very interested. Like, I think this card is already, as we called, I think this is modern staple for those kinds of decks.
Oh, 100%. So. She's going to show up there. The fact that she just makes Court of Calling so good. Court of Calling turns into a counterspell for so many things. Like, just giving stuff hexproof is awesome, and it's, you know, it's an effect that green and white want very badly, but they don't really want to pay for it necessarily. True. You know, like, green and white, when they want that effect, they really want it, but they also, like, aren't that interested in playing Vines of the Vastwood in their deck generally, unless they're, like, Infect. But, right, you know, when you're playing against a deck that's playing Lightning Bolts or Grape Shots, like, you really, really want that effect. And being able to get it off of one creature that's also just, like, a fine creature in its own right, like, you would play a 4-mana 3/4 flyer in a lot of cases, and the bonus text is strong enough that you're very interested. So, this card's really strong, man. It is, exactly like you said, a modern staple going forward.
New Karn, obviously, as to the surprise of no one, a 4-mana planeswalker that you can play in any deck. Pretty good. And when you add, you know, that there are already a number of artifact centric decks in modern, I mean, he was born for this.
Oh yeah, no, I mean, you are right that it can go in any deck, but I think I mentioned this last week, where it's like, yes, this can go in any deck, but it really isn't gonna, you're not just gonna put it in every deck. It doesn't really fit everywhere. I mean, it is a generically powerful card, but you know, your Storm deck just isn't interested in this. There are decks that just don't really want it that bad, but man, the places where the -2 is good, this card is outrageous. It's so strong in Affinity. You know, I don't know, any place playing artifacts. Like, I was thinking Eldrazi Tron could be playing this card. Eldrazi Tron's not super popular right now, but this card would be very good in the deck. Sure. Big Tron could play this. It's just a very powerful card. And, you know, we even played against it in Legacy this week, and it just was crushing my teammates. So I'm convinced the card is just extremely powerful. I think it top four to, was it a Grand Prix in Bologna?
I'm sure. Sorry. Oh, that was, there was an event in Brazil. That it popped up in, and it just was like, yep, there you go.
Yeah, I think it, like, top four in an event in Brazil where, you know, Affinity was playing 2 copies in the main deck. So, yeah, I mean, Karn is no joke. When the -2 is making 4/4s, it's really, really strong. Like, that, like, a Planeswalker to minus to put a 4/4 token into play is outrageous, right?
Yeah.
Like, that's just a really... And the fact that he can do it twice before he dies is ridiculous. And the fact that the decks that are playing him, it's way bigger than a 4/4. It's like you're making a 7/7, and then you make, like, 2 8/8s. It's so... so much power for so little mana, it doesn't even die. Like, it doesn't go away after that. It just keeps making the problem worse. It's, oh man, this card's strong.
Yes, extremely, extremely strong. And especially, like, even in multiples, because the silver counters don't go away. So you can drop him and plus him, get your, like, little tiny factor fiction, and then go. Then your opponent can answer it. And then you play another one, and you still have access to all the cards that you've already exiled. So it's just compounding nonsense.
Yeah, and while all that is true, like, it is even better in multiples than it looks like, just because the -2 is so good in multiples. Like, I can't stress how good the -2 is. Like, yes, when you're playing this deck, it's because the -2 is good. And when the -2 is good, the only thing you want is more of the -2. So it's like, you minus, they kill it. You play another one, you minus, and now all of a sudden you have, like, I don't know, 4 8/8s, 4 10/10s. It's so ridiculous.
Yes. Agreed. And then Teferi, you can talk about Teferi. He's already here. It's happening, and he has started to see play. And based on what you said, I think he is probably going to continue to see play.
Yeah, I mean, Teferi is ridiculous. He, you know, within, I don't know, 2-3 days of being legal, he won a modern challenge online, right?
Yep.
Admittedly, he was a one of, but that's not something planeswalkers from new sets generally do, win modern challenges. He was being played in modern in Jeskai by noted Jeskai master Ben Nikolic instead of Jace the Mind Sculptor. Like, Ben Nikolic could have put Jace the Mind Sculptor in his deck, and he chose to play Teferi, Hero of Dominaria, instead.
Well, no, he did. They were both in there.
No, that's the gift control guy who won the modern challenge. That guy was playing both, and he probably was right to play both because they're both messed up cards. But Nikolic had the choice between Jace and Teferi in his list. He only wanted so many slots for a planeswalker, and he chose Teferi over Jace, and that's ridiculous. Like,
I mean,
we were talking about Jace being
justified.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing, is we were talking about Jace being one of the most powerful cards ever printed, completely ridiculous, completely outrageous, I don't know, a month ago. Fast forward a month, and Jace is good, it's a powerful card, but it's by no means broken, it's not even that good, in Modern specifically, it's still a good card, but, you know, contextually in this format, it's not great, and Teferi, I think, is a little less powerful than Jace on the whole, but contextually in the format, is much better. While they are blue planeswalkers that both kind of just, you use them to accrue card advantage, they're very different in what they're doing exactly. Jace is more of a mind sculptor, if you will. He is, right, like the name says it all, though. It is more about, you know, sculpting your hand over time. It kind of builds up this, you know, card advantage, you know, find the perfect card effect very slowly. And it's a little too slow for Modern. The way it does it, it doesn't work fast, and it's going to win the game if it stays out there, obviously. But, you know, it's not great at protecting itself. It can, but it's just a little slow, a little, you know, just a little too unimpactful the turn it comes down in Modern. And Teferi's kind of like a Jace that's idiot-proof, honestly. Whereas, like, Jace is like a 4-drop, but he's kind of like a 4-drop that you should play on turn 6, if that makes sense, because you kind of want to play Jace and like use your spells to protect him rather than his abilities. And
yeah, you wouldn't play Jace into a board where you have to use his bounce.
Yeah, well, and you do sometimes, because it's like, you know, you're just behind and you just need them to make the mistake of attacking Jace instead of you or whatever. But no, you're totally right. Like, you don't use his abilities. Like, that's what you're getting at there. And Teferi, you don't really either, but Teferi's untapped 2 lands kind of, you know, on the plus kind of puts you in this spot where you play him on 5 and then it's like he costs 3 and now you have 2 mana up. So it was kind of like the right way to play your 3 mana planeswalker anyway, I guess.
Sure.
But the thing with him is that, you know, his minus can answer anything. His plus draws cards and then, you know, kind of untaps lands so you can protect him that turn. But the part that's really broken is once you've successfully defended him for one turn, the plus the next turn is completely busted. Like, it is so underestimated how powerful ramp effects are in blue decks that don't have to pay for ramp, right? Where it's like, the blue deck, all they really want anyway is just their card draw engine so they can keep hitting their land drops and keep finding spells to, you know, trade and just kind of attrition people out. But Teferi is ramp that's also your card draw engine, which is the perfect thing when you have, like, card draw is you have more mana to cast the cards you drew. And so in this sense, he's better than Jace because he's faster. Like, what you're drawing, the card isn't always as good because you don't have the brainstorm kind of card filtering effect, but you're just drawing a mass amount of cards and you're getting more mana to spend it, and he just accelerates your game plan once he's in play so fast that he just turns the corner very quickly. And the thing I was noticing with him, like, I played him in Standard, and it lets you just, you know, kind of double activate Search Phase Cantas. It lets you, you know, cast Gear Hulks and, like, main phase card draw and then untap and then hold up counter spells, so you started, like, double spelling a lot and really burying your opponent. And in Modern, even if you can't double spell, even if you're, like, flooding, he's blue-white, so you play him with Celestial Colonnade, which is awesome because, you know, you get to 6 mana the next turn, you activate your Colonnade, you attack for 4, you untap 2 lands, now you still have 3 mana up, which is a lot of mana in Modern, to, you know, hold up a counter spell or whatever. And he just is a very, very natural fit into these blue-white decks. So I think going forward, we're going to see a lot more Teferi. I think he's better than Jace right now, at least. And card's really strong, man.
Yeah, he seems to be. I am not good at evaluating blue-white things, so I believe you, and I will take your word for it. Stark from the one of our Cabal Paladins asked us to touch on elves a little bit. And the thing that I wanted to sort of cover about elves is Steelleaf Champion is an insane card. It is insane on turn three. It is extra insane on turn two. So if that was your plan, like if you were, say, going turn one Llanowar Elves, turn two Steelleaf Champion.
No. Tarmo Elf. Yeah, turn two Tarmo Elf.
He's Wooly Thakdar.
Wooly Thakdelf?
Wooly Thakdelf. Elftar. Elftar the champion.
I like Tarmo Elf. This sounds like Tarmogoyf.
I get it. I mean, I'm with you.
All right, fair.
So he's a turn two must answer threat, and there aren't a ton of those in Modern. So when you drop this guy at five power, the chances of your opponent having like a real high powered creature to answer it immediately are very low. So you're pretty much guaranteed to at least get one swing in for five. And because he's three mana, he is not a fatal push free roll. So that's a big deal. They can't just sort of like offhand kill him. They actually have to like work for it a little bit. I really
doesn't think die to bolt either. That's very relevant.
Yes. Oh, it's obnoxious. And just side note, in limited, this is like first pick all day, every day. This card is unbelievably ridiculous.
Yeah. I mean, all the triple color ones in limited are outrageous. Like you're going to play all of them. They're great.
Well, as for I drafted tokens, and my opponent was like, "Oh, Steelleaf Champion," and I was like, "Oh, butts."
Yep, can't ever win.
Yeah, no, you literally can't, and that is exactly what happened.
As evasion, yep. So I was gonna make a point to you putting him in elves. I think that recently we've kind of seen elves diverge into kind of two different decks, where there's kind of the green white version that is playing Devoted Druid and Vizier of Remedies and is more combo-y elves. You know, it's more of the Court of Calling version, if you will.
Sure.
And then we have kind of this newer Jund elves version that's kind of Bloodbraid Elf and Shaman of the Pack. Mm-hmm. And I don't think this card is great in the combo-y version. It doesn't really do what that deck's looking for. But this card is a house in the Jund version. It's exactly what you want to cascade into with Bloodbraid Elf. It's, you know...
Oh, God, that doesn't make me happy.
Yeah, I mean, it just is so much power on an elf body. And in that version, they're kind of playing... They're playing a bunch of green lands anyway, because they want to cast, you know, green one-drops, right? But all those green one-drops tap for green, and then they're fixing with lands that lets you cast the triple green, so the triple green is not even a huge cost here, and I think it fits very well in that version. So, you know, casting your Bloodbraid and your Shamans off of... Cavern of Souls and Unclaimed Territories and Giltleaf Palaces or whatever. Mm. Just make it very easy to play this card, and I think it's a natural shoe in there. I think it lets you put a lot of pressure on very quick. It's also really nice with Heritage Druid. It just is like a free thing off a three elf taps. So
yeah. So if you go Heritage Druid into Dwinin's Elite, you get this guy for free.
Yep, boom, tap Dwinin's Elite, Heritage Druid, and we got a turn two, you know, we put, I don't know, what is it? Seven, no.
Five, six, seven, eight power on the board.
Nine. It's nine power. Nine power on board on turn two.
Seems good. I don't think there's anyone who would complain about that.
No, I mean, that's like Hollow One stats, honestly. That's like something Hollow One does is nine power on turn two, right?
Yeah. Ugh, gross. Yep. Yeah.
Yeah, that's there. I mean, that's a real thing.
That is absolutely a real thing.
All right, so what else we got in Modern?
I want to talk about this this deck. All right, so one of the things that we talked about when the set was spoiled is this bird, Teshar, Ancestor's Apostle. And we knew that it was not going to take long for him to get busted, because it's very clearly just like a combo waiting to happen.
Oh yeah, 100%. And
man, it really didn't take long. So this guy, Adam, he is a streamer, or he streams on the Brew City MTG channel, Brew City MTG Twitch channel. So it's him, Arctic Mebo, and I don't know, I call him Aggro Dan. I don't know what his Twitter, whatever name is. They do a lot of stuff. It is quite good. You should watch them stream. But he brewed up this deck, and it is absolutely ridiculous. I will break it down for you thusly. 4 Arcbound Ravagers, 1 Memnite, 4 Mirror Retriever, 2 Ornithopter, 2 Spellskite, 4 Tishar Ancestor's Apostle, 2 Walking Ballista, 4 Ichor Wellspring, 4 Mox Opal, 4 Springleaf Drum, 4 Darksteel Citadel, 3 Glimmer Void, 1 Island, 1 Plains, 4 Seachrome Coast, 4 Spire of Industry, 4 Gifts Ungiven, 1 Noxious Revival, 4 Path, 2 Thoughtcast, 1 Unburial Rites, just cuz, 1 Ancient Grudge, 1 Day of Judgment, 2 Karn Scion of Urza, dudes everywhere, 4 Ley Line of Sanctity, 1 Nature's Claim, 1 Negate, 1 Ray of Revelation, 2 Swan Songs, 1 Wear and Tear, 1 Wrath of God. And so what this turns into is better KCI. And the reason that it is better is because once you are going, you can't fizzle. So you don't have to sit there and make your opponent sit through all of your shenanigans. You can demonstrate a loop where you can generate infinite mana, draw your entire deck, like whatever, and you don't have to like have a possibility of failing, which is the reason that KCI has to sit there and just go, and why it takes forever. So this deck is the real deal. He has made a couple of versions of it. The most recent one, this is the most recent one. I talked to him about it today. He tweaked the sideboard a little bit, but I have seen it and it is very real. So, it has the same kind of core as KCI. So you have Tayshar, Arcbound Ravager, Mirror Retriever, and any zero mana artifact, preferably a Mox Opal, or Springleaf Drum, and you sack the zero mana artifact, it gets a counter, sacrifice Mirror Retriever, gets back your zero mana artifact, then you cast the zero mana artifact, which triggers Tishar, which gets back the Mirror Retriever, and you just do that until you have a, either an arbitrarily large Arcbound Ravager or whatever. You can put the counters on anything, and then you kill your opponent. Bing, bang, boom. If you have an Ichor Wellspring, you can also draw your entire deck. You can get Tayshar on the board with Gifts Ungiven, Unburial Rites. Like there's a lot of redundancy built in. The deck is really interesting. It is not my cup of tea, but if somebody said to me, hey, I really want to build KCI, I would say build this instead.
Yeah, no, I think that's valid. I mean, I think this looks to me like the makings of a very, very powerful modern deck. Obviously, it's still in the brew stage, right? Like, we aren't 100% there. But what it's doing with what's there already is extremely powerful. And, you know, the fact that it is just an infinite loop that, you know, creates an arbitrarily large creature, a powerful way to win. I think, you know, as it gets more refined, it might start to merge with KCI. It might even diverge from it. I wonder if this deck wants the card KCI in it anyway. I don't know. I mean, I trust that he's brewed more with it than I have, so he would probably know better. But, you know, sure. Just what it's doing is powerful enough to be a modern player going forward. And, you know, shout out to Adam at Brew City with this. This is a great find.
Yeah, so the Twitch channel is twitch.tv/brew_city_MTG. It is Daniel. Oh, I'm sorry. His name is Adam. So it's Daniel, Adam, and Allison. They are Marquette University students, longtime Magic players, and they are in a bunch of Magic. All good folks, entertaining, et cetera, et cetera. So definitely go ahead and check them out. Yeah, like I said, it didn't take long for this to happen. So hopefully you got your Tayshars and grab some foils. I'm sure they're still cheap. You wanted to talk about switching decks. So why don't you do that? Because I've no sage advice about changing decks because I do it so often. Like, it's a bad habit for me.
Well, no, I mean, you're right. It can be a bad habit.
But all I have to say about that.
No, it can be. It can be detrimental. It can be certainly wrong to do it on occasion. It depends what you're kind of looking for out of Modern, where if you're just playing for fun, you know, 100% of the time you just go to play for fun, which is definitely a way that you could experience Modern. I think you should try and switch decks as much as you want. That's 100% acceptable in my mind. I personally enjoy casual Magic more when I'm playing with different cards. You know, I'm getting new experiences every time. So if I was just a casual Magic player personally, I would try to play a different deck every time. Now, obviously there's some logistic issues there, but that's besides the point. As for competitive Magic, if you're trying to compete in Modern, switching decks is a very tough thing to do, right? There's kind of this paradox where, I don't know what the actual paradox is. I think it's, like this arrow paradox where it's like, if you shoot an arrow and you get like, it goes halfway to the target and then it goes halfway again. And then it goes halfway again. It never quite gets to the target. I don't remember whose paradox that is, but that's irrelevant. What I'm getting at is when people ask what they should play this weekend in Modern, someone always tells them to play what they know, right? And if you always play what you know, then you're never going to switch decks because you're only just going to play the thing you know. So it's hard to find the right time to switch generally. And it's also just hard to switch in general because you have to learn a new deck, right? So one time it's just like obvious to switch is if you just have a really bad tournament, you just kind of feel like you're off your deck, then, you know, go ahead and switch. But I've seen very good Modern players have a successful tournament and decide to switch decks the next weekend because they think it's well positioned. And I have generally found that to be a mistake. If you look at recent like SEG Tour success, generally what happens is a player will pick up a Modern deck, you know, have a very successful 3-4-5 month run with it, and then kind of fade off the deck as it kind of grows out of date and find a new deck they're more in tune with, more up to date with, I guess. Yeah, so when you want to pick up a new deck, which I would suggest, you know, if you're trying to compete, like you're trying to go to SCGs, I think it's right to do it every 3 to 6 months, something like that. Now, you don't have to. If you're still happy with your deck, by all means, keep playing it. But when you know it's time and you want to pick up a new deck, I have some strategies here for you to kind of take into account and some, I guess, real life examples of someone putting them into practice. So one of the easiest things to do when you're switching a deck is to just play something similar to something you're already versed with and very good with, right? So for me, I have had a lot of experience with Snapcaster Mage Lightning Bolt decks, right? I played Jeskai, I've played Grixis, and I decided that both of those were very poorly positioned something like a month and a half ago. It seemed obvious right after Jace was unbanned to me personally. So I was trying to find a new deck, something else to play. I went back to Mono White Taxes, I tried some Bloodbraid decks, I tried Tron, I tried a bunch of things. I didn't really like any of them. I even tried Humans. I thought Humans was very good, but it wasn't my playstyle. I wanted something more familiar to what I was doing. And I picked up a Blood Moon deck. I was playing Blue Moon, and it worked very well for me. I was very happy with it. I played some stock lists. I didn't really like those, but it felt like what the deck was doing was powerful enough that something was there. So I kept tweaking it and kind of found the build that I like. And it wasn't that hard for me to switch because the deck's very similar to things I've already been doing. Now, it's very different in some aspects. It's more of a proactive control deck, more of a prison deck than, you know, Jeskai or Grixis or any of those three-color decks were. But it's playing a lot of the same cards. It will take the same role in a lot of matchups, so it made the transition easier because there was less to learn, I guess. Now, that's just one strategy. It's not always optimal, right? Maybe just the whole strategy you were doing before is poorly positioned, so it could be that this is just not viable for you at whatever time you're trying to make the switch, which is, you know, it's possible, but it's not unlikely that this could be the case for a lot of other decks. Like, if you are a Merfolk player and you don't like Merfolk right now and you want to pick up Humans, well, Humans plays very similarly to Merfolk. They're very different decks. They do different things, but there are a lot of, you know, matchups where they'll have the same role. They'll have the same kind of things you're looking for. You'll kind of, you know, sideboard in similar ways. You know, you'll approach the, I need to be aggressive here, or I need to, you know, kind of play to the board or whatever it is doing in that matchup. You know, they'll be very similar things. And, you know, for something, you know, another common experience of this change recently has been, you know, dredge players moving to hollow one, which very, very different decks, but similar at the same time, you know? So, those are some very, you know, that's the baseline switch. That's the easiest switch to make, I think, in modern. One thing you should just do when you're switching in general is just read content on the deck you're switching to and watch videos of other people playing with it. That's pretty self-explanatory, honestly, but it's something I don't think is done enough of. I really don't think people do enough of it. I think they'll look up a deck list, you know, put it together and go play, and it's like, it can't be understated how much it helps you to watch Reed Duke play Jund, or, you know, to watch Pascal Maynard pick up his affinity deck, or, you know, just go check out Channel Fireball, go check out YouTube. There are tons of free resources for you to watch this content. Go read articles that people wrote on SCG, you know? It's really easy to pick up some modern content on a deck that you're trying to get familiar with, and it's underrated how much a little extra preparation can help get you that one extra win in a tournament, which, you know, doesn't sound like that much, but honestly, like, you know, sideboarding the correct card in one matchup and then drawing it can be the difference between one win and one loss, and that one win and that one loss can be the difference between day two-ing and not day two-ing, you know?
Right.
So it's like, it is really just a whole bunch of small things, and it's like, you know, a lot of people don't think the homework matters, but it really does. So, you know, go ahead and do that. If you're going to switch, then commit to it. You know, don't switch halfway, I guess. One other little strategy I really like for switching decks is to have the side deck ready, if you will. Just kind of have that one loaded in the cannon for whenever you think you need to bring it out. And this is a strategy I really like to employ, honestly. I will be playing one deck. It's my main deck. I love playing it. I have it kind of going at all times. You know, if I'm going to go to an event, that's what I'm going to play. But, you know, while I'm messing around on Magic Online, I might, you know, play the side deck and just kind of, you know, keep it on the back burner, if you will, until I decide it's the right time to play it. And then, you know, we break it out. You can kind of do this. And this can just be for fun. You know, this is maybe a tier 2 deck, but, you know, maybe just missing one card to change. Like, I could see, you know, someone like Matt Ness keeping, like, a KCI on the side burner for a while and then realizing 2 months ago or whatever that it was great, picking it up and all of a sudden, it's a tier 1 modern deck, right? So, I think the strategy here is, you know, play it at FNM while, you know, you're just playing for fun. You know, play it with your friends while you're just, you know, gathering on, you know, like a Saturday or Sunday afternoon or whatever. And just hanging out and you're playing some side games of Magic. Always a great time. Play it in some side events at a GP. I know you like the strategy, Aaron, where you bring two decks with you and play both of them in a side event, even.
Yeah, and then stubbornly stick with one because you always change, and then play against a bunch of people that you totally could have beaten if you switched to the other deck, but you didn't because you decided to finally stick to your guns and it was the wrong decision. It's fine. Everything's fine. It's fine.
That's fair. That is fair. But yeah, I don't know. The side deck still stands. It's still something you can definitely do.
Yes, it is something you can do.
And it's something I do recommend, because just getting your mindset out of your deck from time to time can really help when you go back to hitting your first deck again, where it's like, you know, if you always play Burn and then you play Tron, you know, as your side deck, well, obviously those are very different decks. They do very, very different things in matchup. One's the extreme long end deck, one's the extreme aggro deck. But, you know, when you play from the other side in a couple of matchups, it really helps you understand the first one, and it kind of lets you bring a fresh perspective back to that deck when you kind of go back to it. So, something I recommend. I don't like, you know, having two main decks at one time. I think that can be a little too much and confusing, but I really do like the side deck where you know, maybe play that deck 15% of the time, you play the other one 85%, if you will.
Sure.
And then the last one, and I think this is often the most underused and difficult, but is very important, is to reach out to people that are already playing your deck. And that's something I don't see people do enough of. I don't hear about it enough. And it's something that I definitely see people do, and I think the people that do it just generally do better in Magic events. So, like, an example of that is, I have this teammate, his name's Brandon Dalloway. He'd been playing Jeskai Control almost exclusively for a year plus, even. And he really liked Jeskai Control. He top-8ed many events. He top-8ed an SCG, top-8ed a Classic, he played a bunch with the deck. He played some Shadow too, but he really liked Jeskai. Played with it a ton, and about 2-3 weeks ago decided it wasn't well positioned and that he didn't want to play it at the team event we were going to play together this weekend. So he tells me he's going to play Storm. And I was like, are you sure, man? That's I think Storm's a good deck, but that's a pretty tough one to learn in 2 weeks. And he goes, well, you know, I don't think that I could learn it, but I reached out to Caleb Scherer. I reached out to Paul Muller, who are two people who have been, you know, doing a lot of Storm streaming and whatnot. And, you know, kind of asked for their sideboard guide, you know, got on their Twitch channel, was watching them play it. And honestly, he put in 8 hours a day just kind of asking them questions, watching them stream, playing his own matches with the deck, and then, you know, kind of gathering questions and bringing it back. And he killed it this weekend with the deck. He was out there just storming people left and right. You know, he wasn't perfect. There were some mistakes made, but that's always going to happen when you play Magic. And honestly, sure. I think he did a very good job. And I can tell you right now that there's no way he would have done as good as he did without having spent the time to reach out to people and kind of ask them. And, you know, a lot of people could say, well, it's hard, you know, to reach out to players that are like that masterful. Like, obviously, Caleb Scherer is a very noted Storm player. It's hard to kind of get that contact. But honestly, like, it wasn't hard. It was all he did was go up and ask him. And, you know, a lot of players are nice and are happy to talk about their deck. And I've seen that a lot where it's like, I talk to somebody who's like a master with their deck and they don't have very many people ask them questions about it. Like, a lot of people will go up to the very top tier player. Like, you know, they'll ask Brad Nelson when he's playing in Standard, right? And, you know, that player will definitely get overwhelmed. But if you go like a couple players down, well, they, you know, the couple players down are still going to be awesome with the deck. They're still going to know so much about it, have all this knowledge, and they're generally very, very happy to talk with you. And even if it's just like the best player at your store, like, I'm sure that player is going to be happy to talk with you about their deck. They always have something to teach you. And, you know, if you do more of that, you're going to get better quickly. So I think that's the strategy I'm pushing this week, just because I saw it firsthand. And, you know, if you're going to switch, go for it. Go. Don't be afraid to reach out to somebody, ask some questions. And honestly, like, what's the worst that's going to happen? They just don't answer. So whatever, you know, at least you tried.
Yeah. You just suck it up and move on.
Yep, exactly.
No, I mean, I think that's in specifically in what you're talking about. I think that's a good strategy, but also in general, just people that get better usually do so by finding people that are better than them and playing against them, right? Yep. Or talking to them, or preferably both. Because there's some things that you can get through discussion, right? Like, you can get somebody's sideboard guide and go, oh, check. Okay. This thing, even if it's something that may seem good, you know, this person has 1,000 reps with the deck and they've played this particular match 150 times. They have determined through actual practice what is and is not optimal for that match. You take that person's advice. You
know, I actually have a really awesome example.
The hardest things.
Sorry, Aaron. Sure, let me cut in on that. I have a really awesome example of that. So a long time ago in Standard, Fairies was a very, very dominant deck, right? And at the same time Fairies was in Standard, there was a 5-color control deck that was kind of trying to be the control deck of the format. But it had a horrible matchup with Fairies. It really, really struggled against just the Fairies tempo, get under you, counter your stuff strategy. And it seemed like it was impossible to beat the deck at first. And what it felt like was if they played a turn 2 Bitter Blossom, you could never win. And what happened was, you know, like, some of the best control players at the time, like Guillaume Magnan, Patrick Chapin, all of them kind of sat down and played like 1,000 games of 5-color control against Fairies. This is like kind of like a legendary thing that I've heard them talk about a couple times. And so one of the key cards of the 5-color control deck is Esper Charm, which is a card that still sees some play in Modern, but essentially what it says is it's an instant for black, white, and blue that says either draw 2 cards, make your opponent discard 2 cards, or destroy target enchantment. And one of the problems for the 5-color control deck in the matchup was that Fairies had Bitter Blossom, which is a 2-mana black enchantment that makes a 1/1 flyer every turn.
And, well, and makes a fairy, which is extremely relevant because Spellstutter Sprite is a ridiculous card in that exact scenario.
Yeah, no, 100%, right? Like, it is good, especially, yeah, right? So it's good there. But the thing that kept throwing everybody off in this matchup and why 5-color control would never win was it was just so obvious that if they played Bitter Blossom, you were supposed to cast your Esper Charm and use the destroy target enchantment mode. Like, it just seems obvious, right? Like, that's what you're supposed to do. Well, it turns out that the way you actually won the matchup more was to, if they played a Bitter Blossom, you cast Esper Charm and drew 2 cards. Because it was more important to start developing your resources than it was to cut down on theirs. And that's so, like, backwards from like how the cards look like they should play out, that nobody did it. And it took them playing like 1,000 games to kind of learn that. And after they learned it, it kind of switched the matchup more into five color control's favor. Like it wasn't, you know, favored by any means, but it went from like a 40% matchup to like a 51% or something. And that's like something that you would have only known if you'd played actually 1,000 games, right? And like once people caught on, they kind of asked them like how they figured this out. And it was like, well, this is what we're doing. This is why we're doing it. And this is why it works. And then it kind of switched the matchup in general. But, you know, it only happened because people, you know, took the time to actually ask them.
Yeah. I guess the main thing is if you're going to do that, which I would encourage people to do, like seek the advice of people that are better than you, is two things. First, be humble, right? Like this person, the entire reason that you're going to this person is because you have already conceded that they know more about this specific thing than you do, because otherwise you wouldn't be asking them.
Yeah, 100%. That was actually going to say that it was, you're going to somebody who's an expert in this. Like they, you might be a better Magic player than the person you're going to, right? Or you might be worse. Like that's not relevant. What's relevant is that they know more about the topic you're trying to figure out about. Right.
Right. And so you need to approach them sort of with that mindset, with that student mindset, and sort of resist the urge to take what they say as like an indictment, because they're likely to say things that you may not agree with, instead of like trying to go back on them and be like, oh, well, you know, my experience is blah, 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 blah. Like that's, yeah, I guess it's fine to have that discussion, but like have it in a way that still allows for the fact that like you do at some point, if you're a reasonable person, have to defer to the experience of somebody who has actually done it. So your experience may be different from theirs, but on the whole, right, if you've done it 100 times and they've done it 1,000 times, they have a much bigger sample size to work with. So they can say, yes, on the whole, strategy X is more likely to result in you winning a match than strategy Y. And even if you're like, well, you know, the 100 games that I played, I did strategy Y and it worked out really well for me, that's all well and good. And that's something that you can say, who knows, but you know, just put your, as I tell my daughter, put your listening ears on and bring that into the discussion. So that's the first thing. And the second thing is like, people, especially at events, are busy. They are often, one, preoccupied with the event, two, like have actual real lives that are going on that don't have anything to do with the event, and they may not have time to talk to you, and that is 100% okay. So I think people feel like sometimes people, like nobody owes you their time. So if you go up to somebody and say, hey, can I talk with you for a few minutes? And they're like, no, that's okay. Right. Like that is a very reasonable, acceptable answer to get. And you have to be okay with that.
No, you 100% do. But I would like add an addendum to that, I guess, where it's like, you are 100% right. Like events are super busy. There's a ton going on. They might be preoccupied with, you know, their last match or their next match or focusing on something with their team. Who knows? Right. So when you're hitting them at this time crunch, they might just say no out of like, I don't have time to talk with you right now. I've got, you know, to get food or fill up my water bottle or whatever in between rounds, you know? And it's like, if they say no, you go, well, hey, I would like to contact you. I'm really interested in learning about this deck. Is it cool if I, you know, message you on Monday or Tuesday after the event, maybe next week sometime, something like that. I've generally found Magic players just as a whole are very happy to to discuss a deck. They love doing it. It's one of the reasons they play Magic. And I think if you phrase it like that, you're going to have a very good chance of getting an opportunity to talk with somebody about their deck.
Yes. Yeah. I would agree with that. So yeah, just sort of be patient, be respectful of other people's time. And you know, just because we have a tendency in this, and I'm guilty of this too. You know, people that we interact with online, it's easy to sort of build in your head the feeling that you have more of a relationship with a person than you actually do. Because, you know, when you're interacting online, you're like, oh, great. Like we talk all the time, but that's like a little tiny, you know, percentage of that person's life in the same way that it's a tiny percentage of your life. And so when you maybe meet that person, you know, the whatever 5 or 6 Twitter interactions that you've ever had with that person, it's a very good chance that they're not going to remember that, right? Like they have an entire whole life that doesn't involve being online and whatever. So don't take that as like a slight or like you're like, oh yeah, you know, like we talk on Twitter sometimes. I mean, people talk to a lot of people online, you know, just sort of be cognizant of the difference between being sort of like online acquaintances and being friends in real life, because there's a big bridge between those two things. And it's not like nobody ever crosses that bridge. They certainly do. Generally speaking, it's not like right out of the gate, right?
Yeah, no, for like, sure.
I'm just going to roll up on somebody and be like, oh my God, I love everything you do. Let's be best friends. Bah, 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 bah. Like that's overwhelming for people. So yeah, just be cool. Like most people are, like you said, they're very chill. They are excited to talk to people that are interested in things that they do. And, you know, so go into it with that mindset and you're almost certainly going to learn something and get better.
Yep.
We had one of our patrons, as a matter of fact, asked about prison strategies and specifically about land destruction. And since land destruction is kind of part of my wheelhouse, I figured I would touch on that aspect specifically of sort of like prison / resource denial decks. I've said this a lot before. It is no less true now than it has been in the past. Running pure resource denial in modern is difficult because we don't have access to the same kind of acceleration, like Ancient Tomb, City of Traitors, those sorts of things that make sort of heavy legacy prison decks really just like come right out of the gate and be like, okay, Ancient Tomb, Chrome Mox, Trinisphere, go. Like that is crazy. We don't quite have that. I guess you could make an argument that the all-in, like, turn one Blood Moon decks are kind of like that, but they're not as widely applicable, and there's plenty of decks that just don't care about that. So you've then, in the grand resource exchange, right, you've spent, like, 4 cards to get this Blood Moon out on turn one, and then your opponent just plays a mountain and then goes Goblin Guide and then proceeds to murder you. Like, it's not the same. That said, you can use land destruction as part of a resource denial strategy that also has a proactive element. What I try to think about is what's the shell? There are control and sort of ramp shells. Stuff like Ponza is a ramp shell. Any of the big mana decks that include a land destruction element. So some of the Jeskai control decks that run really long that have Johnny Vengeant, any of the decks that run like Acidic Slime, Muwan Vuli Acid Moss. I hate that word. Oh, it drives me crazy.
Muwan Vuli.
Muwan Vuli. So Acid Moss is a combination land destruction ramp spell. Certainly, you know, turn 3 Karn minus on your land is a very real land destruction strategy. And even more recently, you know, we talked about obviously a lot of Dominaria cards. Fall of the Thran is an extraordinarily powerful card. 6 mana Armageddon is still pretty good, turns out.
Well, it's like, that's just not an effect that's in Modern, man. Like, it's really hard to find Armageddon. There's not very many of them printed at all. And right, like, if you're looking at cards specifically printed in Modern, like Destroy All Lands generally is on cards that cost 8 or more, or like Ultimates of Planeswalkers, like a Johnny. It's not a common thing.
Yeah. So in that sort of ramp world or control world, you can very easily like tempo your way up to six mana and then just like boom, blow up the world, or you can just straight ramp your way up there, you know, like Utopia Sprawl, Arbor Elf, ba 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 ba, bam, blow up the world. Those are definitely options for those kinds of shells. There are also kind of early resource denial decks, stuff like Crack the Earth. There is there's a couple of Mardu smallpox shells that use Crack the Earth and Flagstones of Trocare. So that's something you'll see a lot of. So you go like Flagstones, Simeon Spirit Guide, Crack the Earth, your opponent sacrifices their land. Like if you're on the draw, you do that. Your opponent has like one land out. They sack their land. You sack your Flagstones. You go get a Plains, and then you've just basically time walk them. Boom Bust, the new way that Boom Bust works, which is the intended way.
Hold on, Aaron.
I know you're.
I was gonna say, can we just have like a quick moment of peace for the old way that Boom Bust worked? Yeah, I really enjoyed it.
Yeah. So for those of you that don't remember that horror show, there was a hot minute where Goblin Dark Dwellers could basically flashback Boom Bust and you could get the bust effect, which is destroy all lands.
Yeah, there's no way you should have been able to get that, but oh my god, was it wonderful that you could.
Sure. It was fantastic.
I'm serious. Like, one of my honestly, like, I'm gonna just quick story time here. One of my favorite moments of all time in any event I ever played was I was playing a Jeskai Mardu or Jeskai Nahiri deck, playing like Ancestral Visions and all of this stuff, and I got paired against Tron for winning into day two. And game one, he smashes me. In game two, I keep a hand that's just like four lands Nahiri. I'm just on five, and I'm just like hoping he has nothing. And he just had nothing, like didn't Tron me, and then I just like Nahiri'd him and Emrakul'd him and killed him somehow. And then game three, he's on the play, and I was like, turn two Stony, and he like laughed, and I was like, all right, I think I can deal with that. And like plays, and like, I think he like killed my Stony with something, but then I go turn three Boom Bust, blow up a land. And he was like, okay, that was pretty good. And then he like starts getting it, and he's like, he's about to like reassemble a Tron, and I cast my turn five Dark Dwellers, and he just sits there and stares at me casting Dark Dwellers, and like calls a judge. He's like, judge, does this work? And I'm like, yeah, it works. I'm going to cast Bust. And the judge is like, yeah, it works. We put all the lands in the graveyard, and five turns later, he died to Dark Dwellers.
Yeah. I'm not sorry that the interaction doesn't exist anymore.
Oh, it was wonderful. So good.
Yeah. So part one is certainly decide what you want to do, right? Like, smallpox is the same way. It's, you can either take the early advantage and try and press it and sort of ride that to victory, or you can play the long game and sort of go bigger, where you're like, I don't care if you have two lands, because I'm then going to blow up three of your lands or all of your lands, and then, you know, proceed to beat you down with some giant thing. If you are looking for very specific things, this is especially in a known metagame. So your FNM, your store, your area, if there are a lot of greedy mana bases, right, a lot of three color decks, you're going to look at stuff like Ghost Quarter, Blood Moon, Spreading Seas. These are all things that are going to hit, you know, your Fetch Shock, three color, Jund, Sultai, Mardu decks, maybe Mardu not as much, but definitely Jund, Grixis to a certain extent, because they're not playing a ton of basic lands. They're playing more than they used to. Like, there was a time in history where like you would play one. They're playing more than that, but not much more than that. Similarly, if you know there's going to be a lot of blue based decks, a lot of, I mean, even if you want to go deep, that's even not that deep. So like, if you know for some reason that you're going into a metagame where white is going to be extremely prevalent and you have access to Flashfires, Destroy All Planes is a very relevant line of text in certain scenarios. So, you know, just sort of have that in your pocket. Boil, same thing, right? Four mana, instant speed, destroy all islands. Obviously, it was the Jace tech for like a hot minute. Most people, I think, that are still concerned/overly concerned about that are back on Choke, seems to be the thing of choice. But, you know, I could definitely see a world where you kind of know what's happening and you're like, yep, three in a red, destroy all planes is part of my plan, part of my sideboard plan. If there is, if you know that what you're up against or likely to come up against is heavy on non-basics, Blood Moon, once again, great. Molten Rain, Field of Ruin. You know, Field of Ruin is definitely, I would say it is main deckable at this point if you can support it. But if you don't care about their basic lands and you just need to hit their utility lands, you need to kill their Gavinny Township, you need to kill their third Tron piece, their Desolate Lighthouse, like whatever the thing is, Field of Ruin will do that admirably and it doesn't set you back. And, you know, if you build your deck right, and, you know, who knows, you may end up strip mining your opponent and getting yourself a land. Like, you being land neutral and your opponent being down on land is insane. So long story short, figure out what your game plan is. You're either trying to disrupt them early, stick a big threat, and then ride that to Mexico, or you're just trying to go over the top of them and then either generate mana through without having lands. So if you're playing like a big mana rock deck, or something where you can just sort of generate arbitrarily large amounts of mana where an Armageddon doesn't matter. So you just, as something like Restore Balance even, is similar to that, where you have just five or six mana rocks, you cast Restore Balance, you have no lands, they have no lands, you can still cast spells, they can't cast spells. That's what you're looking for, right? In the sort of prison / resource denial, if the resource that you're attacking is mana, this is how you do it. Hopefully that's sort of a quick rundown of sort of picking your best land destruction. There is way more to talk about, and we can probably hit on it next time, because there really is, there's a strategy for denying every kind of resource, pretty much, even down to like draw step, attack step, you know, even I guess, you know, blocking. Like, there's really, depending on what it is that you are, what resource you're trying to deny, you can get very granular with it and go down to like, I want all my creatures to have evasion so that I'm denying my opponent a blocking step. And that's a real thing. Like, that's part of how Merfolk wins. Your opponent doesn't get to block. Kill you with a bunch of fish. A lot of stuff about prison.
I'm gonna say, did we get them land destructed?
I think so. I hope so. I mean, that's...
Dude, all I'm gonna say is, if we're gonna destroy the lands, destroy all the lands.
Yeah, I mean, sure. If you're gonna go, like, what is...
Destroy all the things!
Yeah, I mean, it's like, bust. Bust is 6 mana, Fall of Thran is 6 mana. The specific ones are usually 4 mana.
Johnny. I'm in a Johnny fan. Johnny's 4 mana.
Yeah, well, he's 4 mana. Like, yeah, 8. He's 4 mana, and then eventually you get there. But that's the long grind, right? Like, that's the long Jeskai grind where you're yeah, using him to like tap stuff down or Lightning Helix something, and then 8 turns later, after you've been like cryptic tapping their team and bouncing all their stuff, you finally ultimate him, and then they're just on.
Oh, you got me excited now. Now I'm thinking, Teferi Emblem will like exile all their lands. Ajani gets rid of them. Can we just get them all together? Just the Teferi Ajani combo.
Well, I'm pretty in on like follow the Thran with Darksteel Citadels on my side, and not.
Ooh, and Flagstones attack here.
I mean, I'm ready. I'm so ready.
Yeah, this sounds nice.
So like. Yeah, so like Flagstones, it doesn't blow up your Darksteel Citadels, and if you have like what is that stupid card? Nile Spellbomb.
If you had a Dryad Arbor, your Tishar could bring it back from the graveyard, right?
I guess
like an Opal or something. I don't know. That might be going too deep, but that's a thing.
I guess it is. I don't know if that's I don't know if that's good. Dryad Arbor is like, it's not even a, I was going to say it's a Harsh Mistress, but it really isn't. It's just kind of like a, it's a very medium card in most scenarios.
Yeah, it's not very good.
Like, it's a...
It's not very good unless it's, like, way too good.
Yeah, it's a land that has Summoning Sickness, like, because it's a tap land that also, like, turns all of your opponent's removal into a strip mine. I don't know if that's great. Hey, whatever. Did you have anything else that you wanted to add before we move on?
No, let's wrap this puppy up. We got a big spice rack this weekend. Or this week, I guess.
Very spicy.
As it were.
Indeed. So, before we get to the spice rack, you can follow us on Facebook, facebook.com/Turn1Thoughtseize, all spelled out. You can follow us on Twitter. I'm at T, the number one Thoughtseize, and Zach is at A22EN. You can watch a stream at twitch.tv/T, the number one Thoughtseize, sponsored by our friends at Card Hoarder. You can see our YouTube videos, youtube.com/Turn1Thoughtseize, all spelled out. You can read my columns at blog.cardkingdom.com. You can become a member of the Thoughtseize Cabal at patreon.com/turn1thoughtseize, all spelled out. And you can see all of our content on turn1thoughtseize.com. The spice rack this week is Yargle, the Glutton of Urborg.
Okay, Yargle is not a modern card. Yargle is sweet, but he is not a modern card.
I wouldn't play a 1-mana 9/3, let alone a 5-mana.
Oh, wait a minute. I might play 1-mana 9/3.
I wouldn't. Are you kidding
me? I might. That one we're getting... you got me interested, at least. I'd play a 1-mana 3/3, so I'd probably play 1-mana 9/3, right?
I don't know. Yeah, I guess. I don't know. Maybe.
Look, this one even has the bonus of being more resilient to Fatal Push.
It sure does. Thank God. With that as his only advantage, I do not see a home for him.
No, probably not.
That said, so the actual spice rack card is, however, a card that can get him if you cast it. And that card is Board the Weatherlight. Board the Weatherlight is 1 and a white for a sorcery. Look at the top 5 cards of your library. You may reveal a historic card from among them and put it into your hand. Put the rest on the bottom of your library in a random order. Artifacts, legendaries, and sagas are historic. This is a very familiar text. To anybody who has played Modern before, it is basically the same text as Ancient Stirrings, except it's not green, it's white. In a deck that is designed to take advantage of it, which is very easy, and there are already, like, the fact that now Planeswalkers are legendary, artifacts are historic, sagas to a lesser degree, having a white Ancient Stirrings, like functionally Ancient Stirrings, is very powerful. And I was expecting to be very underwhelmed by this card before I started building my my white stacks deck, which is like an artifact prison deck, basically. But, you know, people were like, oh, why aren't you playing green? I'm like, I don't want to play green, because if I'm going to play green, then I might as well just play Tron. I don't want to play Tron. That's not the point of the deck. So, like, part of it was contrarian, but part of it was also, like, I am building it to be a very distinct deck from Tron. And so that I've noticed, I've found a lot of sort of, like, interesting little interactions with Board the Weatherlight and stuff like Darksteel Citadel. So it does kind of function still as an Ancient Stirrings, because you can hit Darksteel Citadel off of it because it's an artifact. So being able to...
You can also hit Legendary Lands, too.
I mean, there's a lot of... corner things. So I've definitely hit, you know, my share of Inventor's Fairs off of it. You know, obviously Darksteel Citadel, I play more of them, so I hit it more often.
I mean, there are enough, like, random legendary lands that, like, don't cost you that you can definitely turn this into an Ancient Stirrings, mm-hmm. where it's just going to hit, like, almost, like, honestly, like, it can be, like, a less restrictive Ancient Stirrings if you're willing to build around
which
it.
Which I am.
Where it's, like, there are multiple white legendary lands that you can play and play multiple copies of. Like, one we just mentioned earlier, Blackstones of Trocare, untapped white legendary land, comes into play untapped. Perfect. Iganjo Castle. Like, putting one Iganjo Castle in your white deck is almost free, and especially when there's legendary creatures, like, it's just playing with upside.
Absolutely. So you had actually, before the show started, we were talking about what to pick. You would come up against this in some MTGO shenanigans. So why don't you tell us about that?
Yeah, I mean, I have to give a shout out for this, because I was playing on MTGO, earlier today, and I come playing against a guy you know, we look at our hands, and he goes, turn one Untaidaki, the cloud keep, what is it? Untaidaki, the cloud yep. keeper, tap, go.
Which is the, and I'm like, is the legendary land, is one of the champions of Kamigawa legendary lands. This is the one where it's ETB tapped, and then it's tap, pay two life, add colorless, and you can spend this mana only to cast legendary spells. This saw a very, very brief bump right after the legendary planeswalker change in a bunch of jank decks, which is why it's $4 now instead of a penny, which is what it should be. Continue.
Well, it should be a penny. Like, it used to be a penny, but it's a really powerful card now. Now that it's a legendary, you can find it with Fall or Board the Weatherlight. You can tap for it to make two mana for a lot of cards. It's a powerful card, but he was playing this pretty sweet, was playing this very sweet blue-white Legends deck, I guess. I don't really know how else to put it. It had Mox Amber in it, which was really awesome. Untaidaki, the Cloudkeeper. They were trying to cast turn two Thalia Heretic Cathar to make all their opponents' lands come to play tapped, which they did to me successfully. They played the turn one Untaidaki, turn two Plains Thalia. And I'm sitting there with some fetch lands in my hand, like, oh boy, this That's is going to be tough. Yep. And then they cast a turn three Grand Arbiter Augustine the Third or Fourth or whatever, which is a really, really unfair card to get out early. Basically, it makes all my spells cost one more, and all of their spells cost one to two less, which is just outrageous.
Yeah. So it's two white blue for a 2/3 legendary human advisor, irrelevant creature type. White spells you cast cost one colorless less. Blue spells you cast cost one colorless less, and spells your opponents cast cost one more. A mighty 2/3 body. So normally for a 4-mana investment, sketchy, but for a 3-mana investment, I'm interested. I'm in it.
Yeah, exactly. That's something you're very interested in. And it, the fact that it powers up Mox Amber, makes you even more interested in it. And the deck just had a bunch of blue and white legends that were very relevant. You know, Geist of St. Traft, it could play Teferi, it could play Jace the Mind Sculptor. All of these are cards that are awesome to cast with Untaidaki, and even better when you get out early. I'm sure he's playing one drops, although I didn't personally see them.
I have to assume there's at least a couple of Isamaros in there, because like there's, you certainly have that like nut opening of like Plains, Isamaro, Mox Amber, some other spell that costs one white.
Probably like Kithion, but Dragonlord Ojutai is another sweet one to cast. Like, this was a cool deck, and, you know, it probably isn't super competitive, but just what they were doing, like, there's potential here. Like, I hope someone picks this up and keeps brewing with it, because it's really sweet. But for the record, the person's MTGO name was Air Farmer, so shout out to you, Air Farmer.
Yes, wherever you may be.
This is good work. This is good work out of you.
Well played, Air Farmer. So yeah, that is what we got for this week. So thank you so much for listening, and we will talk to you next time.